However, there does seem to be a great amount of unevenness in the treatment of the various facets of the pipeline construction. I think one of the weaknesses is in particular details in regard to the actual engineering for the pipeline. One of my main concerns is the effects of several natural environmental hazards upon the integrity of the pipeline. According to a map, the University of Alaska, that pipeline must cross some 14 or 15 faults. Some of these faults are active. At times, during an earthquake, a fault may slip maybe perhaps some tens of feet, subjecting the pipe to rather considerable shear stresses. Will the pipeline be able to withstand these stresses? If so, would it be able to withstand these stresses when it is at its operating pressure? I've heard of pressures up to 1,100 pounds per square inch, which I also gather is about 80% of the yield strength of the pipe. Another question, so if the pipe itself can withstand these stresses, what about the welds and the joints? What procedures are going to be used to ensure that the welds will hold under these stresses? I have posed these questions to people of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, and I've been assured that they know what they're doing and that we have nothing to worry about. However, I would like to see some assurance from other independent individuals, some people who are equally as qualified as the engineers with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, but who are independent from them. What I have been able to gather in the stipulations has not indicated that we have yet this type of personnel on the project. One of the big concerns about the integrity of the pipeline is that this pipeline holds some 1.5 million gallons of oil per mile. The pipeline will be running many miles up and down grades as it crosses the Brooks Range, Alaska Range, or the Sugach Range, so that we have a potential for a spill of some tens of millions of gallons if a major break should occur. Such a spill would really make Santa Barbara look like spilled milk. So we'd like to see is some assurance from the task force that the integrity of the pipeline will be protected and that the level of risk be reduced to an acceptable level. It can be argued, of course, that the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System has a very vital interest in the integrity of this pipeline. This is true. But what may be an economic level of safety or of security of this pipeline may not be an adequate level for the public, to protect the interest of the public. So what we need is somebody who is sufficiently aware of the engineering considerations so that the public is ensured of an adequate level of protection of its interests. Finally, I would like to comment on the issue of state versus federal control over the pipeline right-of-way. And here, I am representing the interests of Alaskan citizens. Alaska Conservation Society is an Alaskan-based organization. We have no voting members outside of Alaska. I do not think it will be disputed that the federal government has been able to devote more effort to protecting our environment. One only has to observe the level of damage done through oil exploration on the North Slope. The difference between the damage done on state lands and on federal lands to see that much better housekeeping is being done on the federal lands. The federal government began at a very early date to form its task force to dig into these problems of the pipeline, whereas this morning we heard that the state had formed its task force only a couple of weeks ago. Matter of fact, I talked with an official of the State Division of Lands some months ago, and he wasn't aware of any activity that the state was doing. And he indicated that perhaps what they would do would be just to accept the Department of Interior stipulations. The state maintains that it will look after the environment, that has as much concern for the environment or environmental values as anyone else. If they had this, the Hickel Highway would never have been built. However, it now appears that the governor wants to select all the land along the pipeline route. Such a move I consider as irresponsible. The governor's administration does not possess a talent, nor does it seem to have the will to properly oversee the development of the pipeline. The argument that long residence in Alaska automatically gives one the wisdom to manage the environment is patently fallacious. I speak for a group of Alaskan citizens who sincerely appreciate the presence and guidance of the federal government in this time of crisis. It is the federal government, represented by you people on this panel, who have the resources and the will to protect our state for us, our children, and all citizens of the United States. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swift. The next witness is W.B. Parker, Anchorage, Alaska.
At the close of my presentation, I would like to read a letter from Marie Lundstrom of Anchorage, who was not able to be present.
You are right.
Okay, thank you. My name is Walter Parker. I live at 3724 Campbell Airstrip Road in Anchorage. I'm a transportation systems planner. I've been a citizen of Alaska for the past 23 years and have resided here for all but two of those. I have traveled over and through all the areas transected by the proposed pipeline several times. I observed the PET 4 project, except for the first 2 years, the Dew Line construction, and Prudhoe from its infancy. I was very fond of the High Arctic as it existed once, and I regret its passing, but it's irrevocably gone, and there's no way of calling it back. Now, there are two issues at stake here when the pipeline alone is considered. One is developing the engineering and ecological concepts for the construction of a successful pipeline, and the other is enforcing those concepts. And that second point was made very well by Dr. Glasgow this morning. Now, I have no doubt that successful strategies can be developed to overcome the problems involved. The permafrost, rock slides, faulting can be beaten. However, in the implementation of these strategies, there can be wide variance of opinions on the job, especially when economic considerations such as the distance of the gravel haul, the depth of pipe burial, handling of spoil piles, and others become involved. Engineers, once they become involved in a project, can become committed to successful completion within or close to their original cost estimates. On a project of this size, traversing so many different geological and biological regimes, we must have constant surveillance by enforcement personnel. Now, I agree with Secretary Train that 130 men is a minimum figure for field surveillance. And I do not believe that the state can muster a force of this size at this time without almost complete derogation of existing projects, such as the flood control projects desired by Fairbanks and others. If the means is at hand to hire additional personnel, there's a second problem that arises. Experienced Arctic and cold climate specialists are not in abundant supply, and they're not easily trained. It takes a long time to acquire the necessary experience to be a good one. The oil industry has already hired many of the most prestigious and experienced men. The University of Alaska, according to newspaper accounts, is having a hard time coming up with sufficient research personnel for all of the projects being presented to it. Especially Arctic ecologists of the caliber needed for supervision on a job of this magnitude are not easily available. It's all very well to say we didn't have ecologists working on PET 4, but we've changed a lot of our thoughts in the last 25 years. In view of the above problems, I firmly desire that no permit should be granted until the necessary regulatory machinery is established and adequately staffed. I would also hope that personnel assigned to pipeline regulation would in the main be assigned as permanent personnel on the project and not have it incorporated in other duties. This project is too massive and will have too short a building life to be handled as an ancillary duty. If necessary, the project should be delayed until the regulatory personnel can be secured. Another aspect that arises is a complete lack of life support systems for personnel not associated with the oil industry north of the Brooks Range. The only public facilities I know of at present are at Sagwan and Barrow. All others are either military or belong to the oil industry. This is just another aspect of the difficulties involved in regulating and providing surveillance on a continuing basis in this area. And this is one of the major reasons why the pollution and litter referred to by State Senator Palmer and others at the 20th Science Conference exist and continue to occur. Constant surveillance by competent personnel is also necessary if we are to be completely fair to the industry. If a major mistake is made in pipeline construction, both government and industry should have a hand in making that mistake. Otherwise, an adversary syndrome would be created in this state that it would take generations to dissipate. Finally, there have been many allusions made as to the necessity for the completion of the pipeline in the shortest possible time, by the spring of 72, if possible. Unfortunately, the industry has presented no economic studies which prove the necessity of this completion date. Certainly, if this statement is valid, it should be subjected to the scrutiny of competent economists, and then the necessity can be explained to the citizens of Alaska. And the present policy of the Department of Interior has my complete endorsement. I would regret it very much if the policy was changed to accommodate time schedules of unproven validity. And in closing, I would also like to second Mr. Hickok's remarks on the transportation corridor. Transportation planning in this area should be based on need and the systems analysis of alternative methods and not on slogans.
Now, I believe you have another statement that you need to read.
Yes. This letter is from Marie Lundstrom of Anchorage, Alaska. As an Alaskan citizen, voter, and taxpayer concerned with the result of proper and careful development of the state I live in, I am opposed to the immediate construction of the proposed Trans-Alaska Pipeline. I am in favor of progress, but progress should mean improvement of the life most people can live. It is highly questionable to me that immediate, hasty, unplanned construction of this pipeline would improve life in Alaska for most people. My belief is that we need more time and study before we jump in to do a big project like the proposed pipeline. What we finally do in building something of that magnitude cannot be undone, so it should be done carefully and right, if at all. The oil that this pipeline would transport has been here for centuries. It can wait longer. After all, what's the big rush? The oil will not drain away. It will be quite as available later as it is right now. There is no point in making such a large project cost more by starting it too soon. Rather, we should first get a realistic assessment of the full pipeline cost, not only in money, but in living values. We may find that the total cost to our environment is too great to be worth it at all. If we do allow such a pipeline to be built, we should make the stiffest possible stipulations in the construction of such a vast project, and anything costing $1 billion is certainly vast. In order to protect the environmental values that are certainly here now and which cannot be retrieved once destroyed, there is obviously plenty of oil, and the industry is obviously willing to spend money for transporting that oil. Thus, industry should do it properly, and we should insist on not being rushed into something the consequences of which we're not yet sure enough about. We do not need another gross mess that too hasty construction without proper study can create. A fine example of such a fouling of our nest is the winter road to the Arctic slope, the so-called Hickel Highway. That road was built without study or care or concern for the protection of the environment. The result is ghastly, and the damage is beyond repair. That atrocity was made with less than $1 million. What kind of environmental catastrophe could we create with a too hasty and inadequately studied project costing $1 billion? I'd rather not find out. We Alaskans owe it to ourselves to prevent another massive boondoggle. Hold off on that pipeline. Signed, Marie Lundstrom, citizen, voter, taxpayer.
Do you wish to introduce both of those statements as exhibits? Let's mark your statement as exhibit number 38, and then the statement of the other parties, exhibit number 39. Thank you, Mr. Parker. I think for the information of everybody, I'll read the rest of the parties that have registered and indicated a desire to testify in the order in which they will be called. Barbara Blinkley, Vivian Mendenhall, Ralph Sanders, Victor Reventlow, Dr. John Cook, Jim Dalton, Don Hopkins, Charles Edwardson Jr., Rick Gordon, Walter Parker, Stephen Reeve, Ronald Anderson, George Gilson, John Miller, Dr. Ronald Smith, Marie Lindstrom, I have a Hans Vanderlaan down here, but I assume he is the gentleman that has already testified. Is that correct? He does? He does wish to testify as an individual. Hans Vanderlaan, Marie Lindstrom, Lawrence R. Mayo, Charles Herbert, William W. Mitchell, John Clark, David Klein, Gordon Wright, Terry Worrell, Conrad Frank, John Carlson, John Kelsey, Olav Hegelford, George Sillets, Peggy Wayburn, Charles E. Belke. We are planning to recess at 5:30 and start again at 7:30. You might wish to give some consideration, and I don't believe we would have any objection if any of the parties can reach an agreement among themselves to switch their names on the list if it would be more convenient for some witnesses to testify tonight rather than tomorrow or vice versa. The next witness then is Barbara Blinkley, Anchorage, Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, members of the panel, my name is Barbara Winkley. That's spelled with a W-I-N-K-L-E-Y.
W-L-I-N-K-L-E-Y.
W-I-N-K-L-E-Y. I'm an Alaskan resident through choice. I have been living in Anchorage for 2.5 years, and I have traveled extensively through this state, a lot of it on foot. And I'm sure that my concern for the wilderness is will be the same as many other people. I recommend that the actual construction of a pipeline be postponed for a period of time that will enable all pertinent environmental and engineering factors to be appraised and amalgamated further from data gathered over a longer period of time. Dr. Max Brewer this morning made this point clear by explaining the importance of longer study on permafrost in the various areas. Industry and our great Alaskan wilderness can coexist if we are willing to respect the recommendations of the specialists appointed to evaluate the ecological, geological, and engineering implications associated with the pipeline from the north. No amount of revenue, either to our state or to industry, is justified if we are to experience past performances in opening up new territories and wilderness to development. We think of ourselves as the greatest nation on earth, with the greatest resources and technical talent. Here is our opportunity to prove it, to prove also that we have common sense as well as intelligence. Do not destroy this country, not only for us, but for future generations. Most of us are not native to Alaska. We have chosen it as our home. For those of you who wish to develop it, do so. Don't exploit it. It too may well be your home. Thank you.
We will mark your statement as exhibit number 40 then. Thank you. The next witness is Ms. Vivian Mendenhall of Fairbanks, Alaska.
Thank you. My name is Vivian Mendenhall. I've done graduate study in ecology. I too am a recent Alaskan by choice. Most of what I have to say has been said before, but it's brief. It has been agreed that ecological damage is a real danger from construction in the Arctic, and the precautions to minimize damage must be taken. It is plain that it remains to be decided precisely what change will be regarded as damage and what amount of change must be tolerated or may be avoided. We can, for instance, regard a change of a few degrees in the temperature of a stream as immaterial or even beneficial, even if it means losing some fish populations in that spot. Or alternatively, such a change might be seen as endangering an entire watershed ecosystem. The same difference of opinion can exist as to what is excessive permafrost thawing, excessive waste dumping, and so on. I would urge that strict attention be paid to the recommendations of ecologists and wildlife biologists as to the dangers resulting from such changes. I recognize that some changes in the environment cannot be avoided if the pipeline is built, but I urge an ecological perspective in evaluating these possible changes. This will result in stipulations which some may feel to be conservative or in delays. But caution is necessary if we are to remain in control of our Arctic ecosystems. The other matter which concerns me is inspection and enforcement. These remain critical problem after stipulations have been settled upon. Construction practices are only partly determined by the decisions of engineers and commissioners. The effect of construction on the tundra is created by men on bulldozers and cranes. Several gentlemen from the state government have testified that inspection personnel will be adequate to prevent pollution and defacement in areas of state jurisdiction. We were told that there are now large state inspection teams on oil operations around Anchorage. At the same time, we know that oil slicks have polluted the waters there several times in the past year. We have been assured that sanitation inspection will be adequate north of Fairbanks in the future. Nevertheless, it is a fact that at present there is only one sanitation inspector for the entire area north of Palmer, and that funds to pay additional inspectors are not at hand. Thus, I would submit the important problem of inspection as not being adequately recognized or met by the state at the present time. Thank you. I would like to submit this.
All right, Ms. Mendenhall, we'll mark that as exhibit number 41, and we thank you. The next witness, then, is Ralph Sanders, Alaska Carriers Association.
Mr. Chairman, gentlemen of the panel, my name is Ralph Sanders, S-A-N-D-E-R-S. I am the managing director of the Alaska Carriers Association, and as such, represent the trucking industry of Alaska, some 300 trucking companies. I have prepared a statement. I'll present it, but I want to say a few things differently. I completely agree with the remarks of Acting Mayor Porter, of Chamber President Don Bruce, and various other remarks. I'm actually ashamed of some of the remarks that have been made here today, and I view them as completely irresponsible and made without the knowledge at hand on which to base them. Actually, remarks into a record such as this should be completely factual. The remarks about the North Road, the North Slope Road, the Hickman Highway, or whatever you want to call it. The only ones that were made today that are correct are the ones made by Mike Dalton. And two, I wonder what would happen, what would have happened, if the application for a right-of-way for the pipeline had been asked for before oil was actually discovered. The trucking industry completely favors the construction of the pipeline, favors construction at once under proper safeguards. I'd like to have my remarks a little broader, though, than just the construction of the pipeline. That's only a part of what needs to be done. We have to have a completely diversified, completely adequate transportation system. An oil pipeline would be part of such a system. Next, we should have a highway. But not just a highway to the North Slope. That's just a part of the picture. We've got to have highways to serve all of our peoples wherever they exist today, without a means of access, without the means for the better things of life to come to them. We have to treat those people as if they are, in fact, citizens of the country instead of some neglected second-class people. Much has been said about environmental control and preservation of the beauty of nature, wildlife, and any other number of high-sounding and apparently worthy reasons why we in Alaska should halt our forward progress and stultify our approach to economic development, simply because exponents of this theory evidently believe that we cannot expand and develop without destroying the beauty of nature, our wildlife, fishers, and so forth. This theory, in my positive opinion, is absolutely false, without a vestige of foundation, and is an insult to the abilities, dedication, and knowledge of those people in government from time to time to safeguard the present and future welfare of all the people, while at the same time providing for an orderly development needed by those same people, living or yet to be born. It has been said that we have a canal from Fairbanks to the North Slope. This simply is untrue in a vast fashion. Only in low spots in certain very limited areas that would anywhere else require filling in and bridging is this true. It needs to be done in those places in the same manner as elsewhere. Much of last year's mileage could be used right now, after only slight equipment shaping to smooth the surface, as would be necessary anywhere. It amazes me to see some people become so learned based on rumor and fiction. It reminds me of the people that come to Alaska and stay 2 days and go out and write a book and tell all about the state. Even if the aesthetic beauty is changed by road construction in the public interest, it doesn't mean it has been destroyed. It only means that nature has been additionally placed at the service of mankind, as it should be, and as it always will be, if man is to continue to survive. Man will survive, because he has the strongest built-in survival urge of any other creature. Therefore, why doesn't the conservational effort center on basic reality and bring into being conditions and actions that will contribute fruitfully to the support of mankind, while at the same time preserving the maximum amount of our natural beauties, wildlife, fishery, forestry, and other aspects of undisturbed nature? Nature must and will be disturbed to the extent mankind either needs for it to be disturbed or desires it. Our main purpose should be to diminish the effect of desire and augment response to need. There is a matter of reaching our peoples who today have no access by highway, With such access, they would not long, for that reason, remain second-class citizens. They are entitled to the upgrading of their way of life that highways would bring. What of the people living in Nome, Kotzebue, McGrath, Dillingham, or any of the other myriad places where people live in Alaska that are not served by highway? Aren't they entitled to be served? Aren't they entitled to have the things that we have in other places? It has been said by some thoughtless people, thoughtless in my opinion, because I don't believe they would knowingly continue to deny better living to presently underprivileged citizens, that the North Slope Road was constructed only for the benefit of the oil industry or for the trucking industry. What if it had been the mining industry, the fishing industry, the forest industry, or any other industry? Would the same statement be made? Yes, probably so, but by different people. The truth of the matter is, the people, all the people, must be served to their best advantage, even though one segment or industry might be the most immediate beneficiary at times. The trucking industry, by its very nature, equipment diversification and flexibility, is the only transportation mode capable of immediately providing the basic transportation first required by both industry and people. Trucks are followed by railroads, which can handle low-grade, massive amount commodities over great distances at lowest cost due to their inherent abilities. At that time, trucks branch out into new areas, commence to perform feeder services to rail, air, and water carriers, but continue to compete with those same carriers on high priority, fragile, or otherwise specialized freight movements because no transportation mode can provide this premium service nearly as well. Therefore, we say, use the land for man's purposes. Use it wisely, but use it. Use it now when it is needed. That's all.
We'll mark your statement then, Mr. Sanders, as exhibit number 42, and we thank you. We will recess at this time and reconvene again at 7:30. The hearing will come to order. Before we call the next witness, Mr. K. Allen Green has delivered a statement to me for incorporation in the record, and we'll mark it as exhibit number 43. In addition, Mr. Gordon B. Wright has also delivered a statement to me and ask that it be incorporated in the record, and it will be designated as exhibit number 44. The next witness is Victor Reventlow, consulting technologist, Anchorage, Alaska.
My name is Victor Reventlow, R-E-V-E-N-T-L-O-W. Mr. Secretary, distinguished panel. I am here today because I feel that I can help in some way on account of my knowledge of concrete, which at this time I don't carry out as a business, to improve our plans for the North Slope. Oil companies or the discovery of oil, gas, and minerals has provided the reasons and means for opening the Arctic to industrial development. One of the main factors in this development will be the transportation access to this region. Oil companies have conceded the necessity of service roads parallel to the pipeline and are now asking the state for help in this matter. With two of the necessary means of transportation, pipeline and highway, acceptable to all parties, the time has come to include the final and probably most important vehicle, the railroad, in order to complete and obtain lasting access to the far north. I would like to emphasize the construction of a corridor using conventional construction means and new technologies. New technologies which are a load-bearing, insulating, ultra-lightweight concrete. With these technologies, we can provide a maximum protection to the ecology of the region without irreversible changes of native habitat. The lightweight concrete can be placed directly on the permafrozen ground, and a corridor can be built in a single cycle operation. That means by going once over it, with minimum harm to the environment. Maintenance road and railroad can be built simultaneously as a dual ribbon close to the proposed pipeline. The railroad will immediately earn revenues by hauling necessary supplies and men for corridor construction, including the 250,000 tons of freight oil companies say they must have for building the pipelines. Permafrost can provide the finest base for a permanent road as long as it does not thaw. Starting from Fairbanks North, highway and railroad can be placed for economical reasons by conventional means as far as gravel is available, and environmental conditions do not require better construction methods. On the north slope, however, over the tundra and permafrost, lightweight concrete should be used, which provides in layers of 8 to 10 inches better insulation at less weight and more strength than 6 to 10 feet of gravel in order to retain the permafrost indefinitely. Even though the enormous quantities of gravel may be available in gravel islands on the tundra and in riverbeds, the resulting product is only semi-permanent according to the pipeline proposal. In addition, wherever we take gravel away, we make irreversible ecological changes. Transportation roads for this gravel have to be built, which will change the environment even more. However, this lightweight concrete, which has been developed in the past 10 years in West Germany and are patented over there, have only been used as insulating material for roads to retain frost from going into the road against frost heaving, and has never been used to retain the frost in the ground. Therefore, it becomes exceedingly important to test this material in coordinated Arctic field tests. We see a multitude of possible applications, such as roads, railroads, runways, drilling pads, helicopter pads, insulation for pilings, insulation pads for structures and buildings, as well as buildings themselves. Therefore, ask for the support and involvement of all federal and state agencies in securing coordinated test projects using lightweight concrete in the Arctic and other frost-endangered areas. Whether the idea of a corridor is accepted in the long run or not, every likely material should be investigated, explored, tested, and given a chance to prove itself. Too much is at stake for American citizens and taxpayers, whether they are residents of Alaska or not. It has been proven many times that thorough wide-ranging studies have always been more economical and beneficial to mankind than narrow, temporary solutions. This, Mr. Secretary, was actually all I was going to say, but listening, after listening today, I come to the following conclusion. There seem to be about three major routes in the minds of the people who you heard today. Number one was kill the pipeline or the corridor. Number two was delay the pipeline till more knowledge is obtained. And number three, free the land and start the construction regardless how. All three routes are based on either fear, ignorance, or lack of communication. For this reason, I would like to add a fourth route to you. Expedite the gathering of information and knowledge so the Arctic development can progress without delay. The federal government and the state, oil companies, transportation agencies, ecologists, conservationists, all have a common ground and have people to study the same problems. Only in most instances, they keep the results they find to themselves. Why not centralize all this information into one clearinghouse in order to expedite procedures and to do a better job for everybody concerned? Start out by eliminating all points to which nobody really objects, which probably are about 80% of them. And the rest, concentrate on the solution of the differences. They will be solved much easier after all the emotional frills and fringes are stripped from them. The clearinghouse also can receive or will receive information and will give information, which is correct, because all interested parties should be represented in it. And with the institution of this clearinghouse, the Secretary will have the necessary safeguard to grant the right of way much earlier than it appears now. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Ravenlaw. Do you have a statement that you
yes,
would like to?
Yes, I have
to?
Two statements.
Are they both the same?
They're basically the same, what I've said, and the technical background to them.
But is this an original and a copy? Or
no.
They're separate?
They're two separate.
Well, let's mark them then as exhibit number 45 and number 46. Thank you. The next witness is Dr. John Cook of the University of Alaska.
Sir, it has been pointed out many times during this hearing that Alaska is a special place. There is yet another reason for the uniqueness of this region. Through here came the first men to inhabit the New World some 40,000 years ago. These were the ancestors of all the Indians, North and South America. This region has been occupied since that time by many native groups hunting, fishing, otherwise enjoying these special Arctic biomes that we've been. And otherwise enjoying all the special Arctic and subarctic biomes that are now the concern of so many people. We know very little about the history or culture of these people prior to the historic period. This is especially true of the interior parts of the state to be traversed by the pipeline. The prehistoric sites of these early Indians and Eskimos will provide a rich heritage of which the state can well be proud. but it has to be recognized and emphasized that these sites are not renewable resources, and once destroyed by careless construction activities are lost to the public and to the scientific community.
It's going to be helpful if you speak up and sit closer to the microphone.
Very good, sir. These are non-renewable resources, and they must be used with care and responsibility. There are certain laws against wanton destruction of this heritage. These laws, and I must emphasize that these are legal regulations passed by both state and federal legislators, are for the preservation of historic and prehistoric sites, cultural and paleontological. As an anthropologist, I am not interested, however, in merely preserving these sites, but much more importantly, I am interested in preserving the cultural information that is contained in them. This means that we do not worry if the site is destroyed. Such sites are destroyed for our purposes when they're excavated. But if the work has been done under the supervision of a competent archaeologist, the information is preserved. To reiterate, we don't care if the sites are destroyed by construction of this pipeline and the roads and other facilities attendant to it, but we do need to gather the information that is being destroyed. This is the intent and the spirit of all the state and federal antiquities acts, and these are the laws that have to be complied with by the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. As far as I know, however, TAPS does not yet have a program to do this. In order that this compliance is adequate, the work has to be done by archaeologists who have Arctic and or subarctic experience. It cannot adequately be done by Southwestern or Californian archaeologists who are not familiar with the special kinds of sites that are found in Alaska. A good example of this is the recent chaos attendant on the Amchitka finds, where a non-Arctic archaeologist has been doing the work, and things are a little confused right now on that. There are not many of these Arctic specialists. Up to the present, only one has been resident in the state, but there are now four living here in the state who can do the work. Until now, there's been no salvage program for either civil or military construction activities due to this lack of manpower. The road from Lyongood right now is being built without any consideration for the sites being bulldozed under. It is time now for a reassessment of this situation. The pipeline and its associated activities must not simply continue this present policy of ignoring prehistoric cultural material. There must be an adequate program for clearing the right-of-way, these sites, of gathering the available information before everything is gone. This must be done by a team of competent, that is, Arctic archaeologists. Pipeline construction will destroy sites. There's no doubt of that. Some of these sites are already known. There are at least 70 sites in the immediate vicinity of Galbraith Lake, for instance. And many of these are right where the pipeline will go. In other areas along the proposed right-of-way, there are several known sites, and I would expect that large numbers are yet unknown due to the previous dearth of men and time to survey the region. The prevailing philosophy of the archaeologists is definitely not to hold up the progress of the pipeline. There's little probability of the pipeline destroying more than one or two sites requiring substantial excavation, but there are hundreds, and I'm sure most likely thousands, of smaller sites that very importantly give us information about previous settlement patterns, movements of people, ideas in the various northern habitats. Most of the proposed right-of-way can be cleared, as far as Antiquities Act goes, in very short order, since most of the pipeline will be through shallow soil. But it must be cleared prior to actual construction. This will leave time to evaluate properly the more extensive or deep sites with enough lead time to either divert the pipe or excavate that particular site so that construction of the pipe will not lose irreplaceable information. In sum, I wish to place into the record a concern with the preservation of anthropological material and the expectation that existing laws and regulations will be recognized and dealt with by the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System.
Do you suggest that a team precede, an archaeological team, anthropological team, precede the construction on the right-of-way?
Yes, sir, very definitely. There should be a team preceding it and also a team with the construction crew.
And what would be the constitution of such a team? How big and what would be required?
Well, there are some seven spreads working. There should be at least two men attached to each spread. One man well ahead of the actual construction activities, and one man with the spread, so that when construction is actually churning up the earth, things may be seen.
Are there maps presently available to indicate known sites as of present knowledge?
Yes, sir.
On the right-of-way?
Yes, sir.
There are?
Not along the entire right-of-way, largely because we haven't known the entire right-of-way until fairly recently, and the more precise parts of it.
Bert, do we have these? Do you know?
The maps of
yes.
the archaeological sites? I don't think we do.
No, you do not.
They're in the hands of the...
I will be placing them into the record.
Would you make those available, please?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Do you want those part of the record, Secretary Trey?
Are there people working at the task of the sites or at any of these sites on the route at this time?
No, sir.
Are there teams working in Alaska at this time?
Well, there are enough men here in Alaska who can do the work, but we have not been contacted by TAPS yet to clear the work, to clear the right of way. We expect they will.
Yeah.
It was our understanding that Dr. West did get together with TAPS in Anchorage and has submitted a plan.
They
have been in contact.
I understand
sure
they have been in contact with him, but his proposal was turned down, I believe, by TAPS because of the large budget and some other inadequacies in the proposal. I don't know. Dr. West has been gone from the state for a month now, I understand, and he is not back yet. I tried getting hold of him yesterday. I don't know whether there's a new proposal.
How many sites do you speculate there are along the pipeline route that would be worthy of excavation that would fall on that?
Very few that would be worthy of excavation, that is any detailed excavation. But most of these sites the pipeline will be going through very shallow soils, bedrock, ridges, and so on. These are surface sites. These can be collected, mapped, noted. You can do 100 a day. And I expect there are thousands of these kinds of sites. The deeper sites that might have to be excavated, I would say maybe one or two, possibly as many as four. No more, I don't think.
Would you agree that it would take a trained anthropologist to recognize these sites?
Very definitely. Anybody else would walk right over one.
Thank you.
Dr. Cook, I think the record would be more meaningful if you would give us some brief information concerning your background.
I'm an assistant professor of human ecology with the Institute of Arctic Biology here at the university, and also assistant professor of anthropology. I'm also editor of the anthropological papers of the University of Alaska.
Now, when can you provide these maps for inclusion in the record?
Some of them I could have brought today. I didn't
I could give them to you tomorrow.
Could you provide us with all of the maps tomorrow?
No, sir. Some of them have not actually been drawn. They are simply site notations.
Record. I wonder whether it is necessary to have these in the record. If we could have two sets of these maps, or one set which we could then duplicate and make available to TAPS, I think that would serve the purpose.
Very well. Well, thank you then, Dr. Cook. The next witness is Jim Dalton, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Mr. Secretary and Moderator, fellow panelists, my name is James Dalton, and I've been a resident of Fairbanks from 1935 to the present date. My occupation is I'm a mining engineer and a consultant. I graduated the University of Alaska in 1937. My background includes 20 years of field participation in oil and mineral exploration programs throughout the state, including the Yukon and the Kobuk Valleys, Alaska Peninsula, Arctic Slope, and BR4 and adjacent areas. Additional experience included 3 years as General Superintendent for Construction of the Alaska Sector of the Dew Line. I would like to present this as a reading of paper, which I will leave here.
That'd be fine.
Culminating over 2 decades of costly effort on the part of the federal government and the petroleum industry, recent discoveries established that the oil and mineral reserves of Arctic Alaska are of great magnitude and of worldwide significance. Because the demand for Alaska oil and minerals is substantial and ever-increasing, continued exploration and production seem assured. Future progress should be dependent to a very great extent on the development of all-season surface transport systems for large volume movement of equipment and materials necessary for production from riverward supply centers northward to the Arctic, and movement of oil, gas, and mineral concentrates southward to awaiting markets. The systems that have been developed and that are currently in use to supply the Arctic activities, airlift,